also found unacceptable. It was the vital idea beneath all the distinctions and definitions that mattered most to him, and the realization that, at least in retrospect, he had helped bring it to life. Consolidation and diffusion. One area of latter-day revisionism merits special attention, both because of its dramatic and long-term historical implications and because of the passionate intensity Jefferson brought to its reconsideration. This, of course, was slavery, a subject on which Jefferson had been an outspoken opponent early in his career, but only a tentative and elusive commentator later on. He regarded it as absolutely imperative for the historical record, as well as for his own place in the American pantheon, that his moral revulsion against slavery be made clear to posterity, along with his sincere conviction that it was incompatible with the principles on which the Republic was founded. He therefore saw to it that one of his most unequivocal condemnations of slavery was prominently placed in his autobiography. Nothing is more certainly written in the Book of Fate than that these people are to be free. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that considering numbers, nature, and natural means only, a revolution of the wheel of fortune, an exchange of situation, is among possible events. The Almighty has no attribute which can take sides with us in such a contest. The ringing clarity of this pronouncement was designed to leave no doubt about his final thoughts on America's great anomaly. When Abraham Lincoln eventually made the decision to emancipate the slaves, he harked back to Jefferson as his moral beacon, even appropriating some of the language from Jefferson's autobiographical pronouncement in his own second inaugural address. Moral pronouncements aside, Jefferson had also left a long and clear record of procrastination and denial on the slavery issue, despite prodding from several Northern friends, whose consciences were admittedly not cluttered with the practical and financial impediments he faced as a slave owner, and from a few Southern friends who wanted him to assume moral leadership for the cause of gradual abolition in Virginia, Jefferson had steadfastly refused to speak out. "I have most carefully avoided every possible act or manifestation on that subject," he wrote to a Quaker petitioner in what had become his standard response. "Should an occasion ever occur in which I can interpose with decisive effect," he explained, "I shall certainly know and do my duty." In the meantime, any public statement would only be disarming myself of influence to be taking small means. The propitious moment for decisive action, however, kept receding into the middle distance, so that by 1817, upon receiving another plan for gradual emancipation from a Northern admirer, he endorsed it in the most general terms. The subordinate details might be easily arranged, then declared his disappointment that the rising generation of American statesmen, in which I once had sanguine hopes, had not been able to work out these details themselves. He was no longer convinced that the end of slavery was near. Certainly he would never live to see it. "I leave it therefore to time." Silence had become his official policy. What broke the silence and thrust his reputation squarely into the middle of the national spotlight, and in a way he would have preferred to avoid at almost any cost, was the debate over slavery in the Missouri Territory. It began in 1819 when a congressman from New York, James Talmadge, Jr., proposed an amendment to the bill admitting Missouri into the Union that was designed to prohibit slavery in the new state. In his correspondence with Adams, Jefferson's initial reaction to what was being called the Missouri question was calm and assured. He expressed the hope that the issue would pass like waves in a storm pass under the ship. But as the national debate over the Missouri question mounted, Jefferson lost his sense of confidence and his political balance. He began to describe the crisis as the most portentous one which ever yet threatened our Union, and the greatest threat to the survival of the American Republic since the gloomiest days of the Revolutionary War. An old colleague from presidential days who visited Monticello in 1820 described him as obsessed with the Missouri question gesturing dramatically as he walked the grounds, warning of imminent civil war, which would lead to racial war, and then a war of extermination toward the African in our land. His most graphic statement, which became an enduring part of the historical record because of its memorable metaphors, came in a letter to John Holmes, a congressman from Massachusetts. Jefferson explained that until recently he had been content to avoid newspapers and to regard himself as a passenger in our bark to the shore from which I am not distant. But the Missouri question had roused him like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. He went on to claim that no man on earth wanted an end to slavery more than he did, that banishing slavery from all America would not cost me a second thought if, in that way, a general emancipation and expatriation could be effected. But no workable plan for compensating owners and relocating the freed slaves had yet been devised. So, as it is, we have the wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. It was an intolerable and insoluble dilemma. Justice is in one scale and self-preservation in the other. He concluded the letter to Holmes with the most pessimistic and fatalistic remark about America he ever made. I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I live not to weep over it. What was behind, or perhaps beneath, this sudden torrent of outrage and despair? After all, the Missouri question was hardly unprecedented. It merely raised in a new location the question of slavery in the Western territories, which Jefferson had encountered in the 1780s and answered with a clear and resounding negative. It had been lurking in the political shadows ever since his single most brilliant stroke of presidential leadership, the Louisiana Purchase, had placed the entire Mississippi Valley within the national domain. What's more, the idea of prohibiting the extension of slavery into the Western territories could more readily be seen as a fulfillment rather than a repudiation of the American Revolution. Indeed, as a fulfillment of Jefferson's own early vision of an expansive republic populated by independent farmers, unburdened by the one legacy that defied the principles of 1776. Adams, in fact, interpreted the Missouri question in precisely those terms, apprising several of his friends that the extension of slavery violated his sense of what the founders had intended. The present crisis, he thought, represented a welcome opportunity to take a moral stand against an evil of colossal magnitude, before it grew so large and intractable that it put the survival of the American Republic at risk. He did not write Jefferson in this vein. It was another one of those sensitive subjects that put the fragile friendship at risk. When told that several of Jefferson's Southern disciples were arguing that the core issue was constitutional, that the federal government lacked the authority to legislate in this area, Adams insisted that the core issue was obviously moral, not constitutional, and he relished the chance to remind his Southern friends that Jefferson had established the constitutional precedent in 1803. That the purchase of Louisiana was unconstitutional or extra-constitutional, I never had a doubt, but I think the Southern gentlemen who thought it constitutional then ought not to think it unconstitutional in Congress to restrain the extension of slavery in that territory now. Jefferson had, in fact, worried out loud about the constitutional precedent he was setting with the acquisition of Louisiana in 1803. In that sense, his worries proved to be warranted. The entire congressional debate of 1819 to 1820 over the Missouri question turned on the question of federal versus state sovereignty, essentially a constitutional conflict in which Jefferson's long-standing opposition to federal power was clear and unequivocal, the Louisiana Purchase being the one exception that was now coming back to haunt him. But just as the constitutional character of the congressional debate served only to mask the deeper moral and ideological issues at stake, Jefferson's own sense of regret at his complicity in providing the constitutional precedent for the Talmadge Amendment merely scratched the surface of his despair. For him, as for Adams, the deeper issues were moral and historical, the original intent of the revolutionary generation they so poignantly symbolized. And for him, as for the members of Congress, the unmentionable subject was slavery. In the many letters on the Missouri question he wrote in 1819-20, as in the congressional debate at the same time, the word slavery seldom appears, but like the proverbial ghost at the banquet, it dominated the underlying dialogue within the Congress and within Jefferson's own mind. It forced him to declare himself on the question of his own original and final intentions about the unmentionable subject in terms that he knew would not look attractive to posterity. One remark prompted by the Missouri crisis that Adams did think he could safely send to Monticello provides a window into the deeper regions of Jefferson's despair. "Slavery in this country I have seen hanging over it like a black cloud for half a century," Adams wrote. "I might probably say I had seen armies of Negroes marching and countermarching in the air, shining in armor. I have been so terrified with this phenomenon that I constantly said in former times to the Southern gentlemen, 'I cannot comprehend this object. I must leave it to you. I will vote for forcing no measures against your judgments.'" Here, Adams was making explicit the unspoken understanding that, so he claimed, had shaped the behavior of the revolutionary generation toward the potentially volatile politics of the slavery issue, namely that Northerners would delegate the touchy matter of its resolution to Southerners, who obviously had so much more at stake. This was perhaps the most dramatic and hidden meaning of Benjamin Rush's description of Adams and Jefferson as the North and South poles of the American Revolution. From this perspective, what most rankled Jefferson about the debate over the Missouri question was that it was occurring at all, for the debate represented a violation of the sectional understanding and the vow of silence that Adams, the quintessential New England patriot, had faithfully observed. In that sense, the real revolutionary legacy on the slavery question was not a belief in emancipation, but rather a common commitment to delay and a common trust that Northerners would not interfere with Southern leadership in effecting a gradual policy of emancipation. This was why Jefferson so deeply resented Northern leadership on the Missouri question, claiming that they, the Northerners, are wasting jeremiads on the miseries of slavery, as if we were advocates for it. The sectional alliance that the Adams-Jefferson friendship so eloquently symbolized was being repudiated by the rising generation of Northern politicians. Although the civility of their correspondence did not allow it, Adams might have reminded Jefferson that their unspoken understanding was contingent upon some discernible measure of progress toward ending slavery. In fact, the Missouri debate did prompt several fresh initiatives in Virginia, one sponsored by Jefferson's son-in-law, Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr., for a gradual emancipation scheme, coupled with hypothetical plans to deport the freed slaves to either Africa or Santo Domingo. The Missouri crisis seemed to stimulate Jefferson himself to take a more active role in lending his support to these initiatives and to think more specifically about what he had earlier dismissed as mere details. In 1824, he compiled the fullest analysis of the demographic and economic facts he ever attempted and calculated that it would take $900 million to free and then deport the 1.5 million slaves in the United States over a 25-year period. The daunting character of the costs, he acknowledged, made it impossible to look at this question a second time. Moreover, to make matters worse, the 1.5 million slaves would have doubled in number during the time the plans were being implemented, and many of the freed slaves, when offered passage to Africa or the West Indies, would surely say, "We will not go." In effect, the more one thought about the subject, the more one realized that no useful purpose could be served by thinking about it. Only a gradual policy of emancipation was feasible, but the mounting size of the slave population made any gradual policy unfeasible because the population would increase at a faster rate than it could be removed. No one, certainly not Jefferson, wanted to say it out loud or face it squarely, but whatever opportunity might have once existed to end slavery gradually and peacefully at itself ended, especially if one presumed, as Jefferson did, that the freed blacks could not be allowed to remain in the United States. If there had been an unofficial and unspoken understanding that slavery was a problem that Southerners should be allowed to resolve without Northern interference, by 1820 it had become abundantly clear that procrastination and avoidance, which were Jefferson's cardinal convictions on the subject, had rendered any Southern-sponsored solution extremely unlikely. Jefferson's wistful remarks on the intractability of it all left open only a tiny crack of hope. The march of events has not been able to render its completion practicable within the limits of time allotted to me, he admitted, and I leave its accomplishment to the work of another generation. Or, in the same vein, on the subject of emancipation, I have ceased to think because it is not to be the work of my day. In terms of his legacy, and within the context of the silent sectional agreement shared by the leadership of the revolutionary generation now passing away, this constituted a confession of failure. The enlightened Southern branch of the revolutionary generation, which Jefferson unequivocally headed, had not kept its promise. The Missouri crisis made that unpalatable fact more obvious than ever before and made it more difficult, even for Jefferson, to avoid its unattractive implications. At yet another level, the debate over Missouri transformed the huge Midwestern region that Jefferson had acquired in 1803 from a source of release and relief to a source of ongoing contention. The West, as Jefferson had always envisioned it, was a place where festering social and political problems went to find answers. But the Missouri question seemed to reverse the Jeffersonian process. It made the West a new theater of conflict, creating hostilities that then flowed back to Washington and exacerbated the old political and sectional tensions. If the West once seemed like America's fountain of youth, Missouri now poisoned it with the single most lethal subject the American Republic could devise. The position that Jefferson eventually adopted on the Missouri question depended on a considerable extent on his refusal to abandon a quasi-mystical faith in the curative powers of the West. In effect, he argued that the vast lands of the Trans-Mississippi region would dilute and then dissolve the toxic properties of the slavery issue and eventually slavery itself. He called his answer diffusion, the belief that allowing slavery to spread into the Western territories would lead to its gradual extinction. As he put it, diffusion over a greater surface would make them, slaves, individually happier and proportionately facilitate the accomplishment of their emancipation by dividing the burden on a greater number of coadjutors. In a letter to Henry Dearborn, his former Secretary of War, Jefferson hinted that he was extending the line of argument that Madison had first made in Federalist 10. I still believe that the Western extension of our Confederacy will ensure its duration, he explained, by overruling local factions which might shake a smaller association. He seemed to be suggesting, albeit in an imprecise way that requires inspired guesswork on our part to complete his thoughts, that by enlarging the geographic area in which slavery existed, one might multiply the factions for and against its continuance, thereby averting a clear sectional division between North and South that might lead to civil war. If this was what he meant by diffusion and by dividing the burden on a greater number of coadjutors, it was a plan designed to enlist the support of Westerners and provide the isolated slaveholders of the South with new partners in a policy of gradual emancipation. The political dimensions of this thinking are fuzzy. The picture he saw in his imagination is much clearer. Slavery would migrate to the West and simply disappear in the vastness of empty space. When Adams heard that his old friend, along with Madison and Monroe, advocating allowing slavery to spread as a way to ameliorate its effects and eventually kill it, he expressed astonishment, firing off letters to his son, John Quincy, and daughter-in-law, Louisa Catherine Adams, declaring that the Virginia dynasty had lost its collective mind. As Adams saw it, slavery was a cancer, claiming that its spread throughout the body politic would somehow lessen its lethality was bizarre. He also insisted that this new doctrine of diffusion contradicted the original intentions of the revolutionary generation, or at least that segment of the leadership, which surely included Jefferson, dedicated to the gradual abolition of slavery. All had then agreed that ending slavery depended on confining it to the South. The emergence of cotton as a lucrative cash crop and the concomitant spread of slavery into the new states of the Deep South had exposed the weakness of this strategy, but no one until now had ever claimed that the expansion of slavery was helpful to the cause of abolition. Precisely the opposite, the spread of slavery rendered the prospects for emancipation ever more distant. While Jefferson believed that Northern insistence on banishing slavery from the Western territories violated the sectional understanding within the founding generation, Adams accused Jefferson of repudiating the long-shared presumption that ending slavery meant isolating it in the South. In this debate over the true meaning of the American Revolution, which never became explicit because once again it was too volatile a subject for the two patriarchs to share, Adams had the greater portion of historical evidence on his side. Indeed, the ultimate source of Jefferson's extreme frustration with the Missouri question, as well as the source of his frantic and far-fetched efforts to answer it without surrendering his anti-slavery credentials, was that he was trapped within the contradictions created by his own posture of procrastination and denial. Missouri made the long-standing paradox of slavery that he had been living so deftly into an undeniable contradiction. He had all along been living a lie. This was not a tolerable realization, just as it was not tolerable to recognize that Northern politicians had seized the high moral ground, which was normally Jefferson country, from which they were now casting a long shadow over his legacy. Given the intolerable character of this situation, Jefferson reached down once again to the primal categories of his political imagination, which were, as always, moral and binary. The more he thought about the debate over Missouri, the more he convinced himself that the real agenda had little to do with slavery at all. That was merely a pretext, a masterstroke of manipulation by the same sinister forces that had been trying to undermine the American Republic from its very inception. They were called Tories in the 1770s, monarchists or monocrats in the 1790s, diehard Federalists during his presidency, but they were all really agents of the same corrupt cause. "The Missouri question is a mere party trick," he explained to Charles Pinckney. "The leaders of Federalism, defeated in their schemes of obtaining power, have changed their tack and thrown out another barrel to the whale." Although it had been defeated time and time again, this surviving remnant of Federalist corruption was up to its old tricks. Taking advantage of the virtuous feelings of the people, in order to recover political power, using the anti-slavery message as a new instrument to consolidate its control. Consolidation was the new term that Jefferson embraced, other Virginians were using it too, to label the covert goals of these alleged conspirators. In one sense, consolidationists were simply the old monarchists in slightly different guise, or they were a reconfiguration of the courtiers and political henchmen around George III in the Revolutionary era. At bottom, they all were dedicated to the same purpose, accruing political power for themselves in tight bundles of coercion, far removed from any popular restraints or public responsibilities, using slavery in the same way the Hamiltonians had formerly used debt to justify their plot. However flawed this boogeyman explanation was as an accurate description of the political forces that had mobilized around the Missouri question, it was Jefferson's time-tested response to all complex political conflicts, namely, transform the swirling forces into a two-sided contest between good and evil. Simplification and exaggeration had always served him well in the past. George III had not really intended to enslave the American colonists, but rather to tighten imperial control over far-flung colonies. Neither Hamilton nor Adams was really a monarchist, but rather advocates of a stronger executive and more energetic federal government. Moreover, his new label for the enemy, consolidationists, was actually a more accurate description of what had always distressed him about the primal concentration of political evil he saw in the mind's eye. It was organized and clustered together so as to maximize its coercive influence over popular opinion. Diffusion, on the other hand, accurately conveyed the core feature of all truly legitimate political power as he conceived it in his imagination. It was unorganized. It achieved its goals in a silent, slow, and seeping fashion that never resorted to willful coercion. It was natural, almost unconscious. As Jefferson saw it, then, the crisis of 1820 was yet another version of the ongoing struggle that he had waged and won in 1776 and again in 1800. "The same parties exist now which existed before," he wrote to Lafayette in 1822, "only now the enemy has realized that monarchism is a hopeless wish in this country and are rallying anew to the next best point, a consolidated government." The next day he wrote in the same vein to Gallatin, expanding his definition of the consolidation conspiracy to include the proposals for federal controls over roads and canals, that is, all internal improvements. While serving in Jefferson's cabinet, Gallatin had in fact authored the first study of a national system of roads and canals, and most Republicans had long since accepted the principle of federal responsibility for an interstate network of transportation to bind together the geographic regions and connect the coastal states to the interior. Now, however, Jefferson apprised Gallatin that internal improvements were yet another dimension of the consolidationists' plot. "Although this is not yet avowed, as that of monarchism you know never was, it exists decidedly," he assured Gallatin, "and is the true key to the debates in Congress." What Gallatin actually thought about Jefferson's conspiracy theory has not been preserved in the historical record, but the more expansive and inclusive version of Jefferson's demonic vision, which now went beyond the matter of slavery in Missouri to include the entire national program for internal improvements, made it difficult to understand his moral crusade against consolidation, as he himself understood it, that is, as another chapter in the ongoing story of the American Revolution. The ancestral voices he heard and the ghosts of federalism he saw now had the decided look of a massive delusion. Even worse, the embarrassing truth was that he was allowing the enormous prestige associated with his name to be captured by the most reactionary segment of Southern political culture, with its attendant defense of slavery and its doctrine of states' rights. His language became more hysterical and apocalyptic. The decision to limit the expansion of slavery was a mere pretext for ruling slavery illegal throughout the United States, in which case all the whites south of the Potomac and Ohio must evacuate their states, and most fortunate those who can do it first. It was precisely the same kind of scheme Parliament had tried in the 1760s, whereby the right to tax the colonists was a mere opening wedge to establish tyranny in full fashion. He and his colleagues of the revolutionary generation had seen through this trickery, but their successors, having nothing in them of the feelings or principles of 76, were now completely duped into supporting a single and splendid government of an aristocracy, founded on banking institutions and moneyed corporations, riding and ruling over the plundered plowmen and beggared yeomanry. It was the old Whig rhetoric, but now harnessed to the most provincial interests of Virginia politics. Though he expressed the fervent hope that he would not live to see it, there can be no hesitation, he concluded, if faced with a choice between the dissolution of our Union or submission to a government without limitation of powers. Secession was preferable to consolidation. It was a sad and pathetic spectacle, all the more so because it seemed to ring all the familiar chords of 1776 and 1800, but he was in fact linking his legacy to the destruction of the republic he had helped create. Rebel reactionary. There were extenuating circumstances which Jefferson's most ardent admirers, both in his own time and ever after, have been at pains to point out. One way to explain his descent into a nearly pathological mentality is to see it more as a consequence of the Panic of 1819 than the Missouri crisis, two events occurring at the same time. The panic depressed prices and land values throughout Virginia. Jefferson's financial problems and long-standing debts had forced him to sell his huge, about 10,000 volumes, library in 1815 for the relatively meager price of $23,950, and the economic depression that began in 1819 was probably sufficient to ruin whatever slim prospects he ever had to pay off his creditors. But the crowning blow came when he made a loan of $20,000 to Wilson Carey Nicholas, a wealthy old friend and relative by marriage. The panic destroyed the value of Nicholas's extensive land holdings, forcing him to default on his loan and leaving Jefferson with annual interest payments of $1,200. Jefferson immediately recognized this misfortune as what he called his coup de grace. He was rescued from total despair only by the inimitable Jeffersonian style. "A call on me to the amount of any endorsements for you," he wrote Nicholas, "would indeed close my course by a catastrophe I had never calculated." His financial situation was undeniably hopeless after 1819. All his political statements after that date, so the argument goes, must be regarded as the ramblings of a depressed old man, paralyzed by the realization that his bankruptcy would deprive his heirs of Monticello. His major domestic legacy was going to be debt. His political pronouncements over these last years, again, so the argument goes, were colored by the pervasive sense of gloom that his financial misfortunes generated. He was also the victim of his own self-imposed isolation. "I read no newspaper now but Ritchie's," he wrote Nathaniel Macon in 1819, and "I feel much greater interest in knowing what has passed 2,000 or 3,000 years ago than what is now passing." Thomas Ritchie was editor of the Richmond Enquirer, a vehicle for militant states' rights polemics, and Macon was another staunch old Republican who regarded the Missouri crisis as a plot to end slavery in the South. Apart from Adams, almost all of Jefferson's regular correspondents were fellow Virginians like Macon, William Branch Giles, and John Taylor, the latter the most verbose defender of agrarian values and states' rights in the entire country. Outside the Old Dominion, Jefferson's chief source of information on constitutional questions was William Johnson, a Supreme Court judge from South Carolina whose main claim to fame was his sporadic and usually inadequate efforts to oppose Chief Justice Marshall's ringing endorsements of federal authority over the states. All in all, then, Jefferson's sources of political information were highly partisan and narrowly provincial. Small wonder that his own views became distorted by similar prejudices. Finally, there is the much-quoted defense by Madison. Jefferson had asked his old disciple to take care of me when dead, a poignant request that the ever-loyal Madison did not fail to fulfill in the 1830s, when Southern secessionists tried to claim Jefferson as their own. No one could challenge Madison's claim that he knew Jefferson better than any man alive, and he expressed his clear conviction that the charges against Mr. Jefferson, meaning the claims on his patrimony by secessionists and resolute states' writers, can be duly refuted. Madison observed that allowances also ought to be made for a habit in Mr. Jefferson, as in others of great genius, of expressing in strong and round terms impressions of the moment. A few latter-day utterances, lifted out of context, ought to be allowed to align Jefferson's long legacy with the most reactionary elements in the South. Coming as it did from Jefferson's closest confidant, who was also a Virginian with impeccable credentials as a defender of Southern interests, Madison's insistence that Jefferson not be taken literally as a supporter of secession was both plausible and compelling. Each of these efforts at extenuation and helpful explication is true enough, especially Madison's warning that Jefferson's most disarmingly extreme statements not be seized upon in isolation as fair samples of his final thoughts. But it is also true that efforts to dismiss his latter-day political pronouncements as aberrations will not do. Whatever impact his final predicament had on his emotional stability, he found ways to shield himself from the full implication of the indebtedness until only a few months before his death. using the same denial mechanisms that had served him so well throughout his life. And the narrowly partisan character of his correspondence was not just some accident of fate. Jefferson chose to focus his exchanges on politics with spokesmen for a Virginia writ large version of America because they tended to share his sense of impending doom for an agrarian society and a way of life that was inextricably bound up with slavery. Even Madison's persuasive defense that Jefferson had an inherently rhetorical way with ideas that ought not always be taken literally must be challenged, since the rhetorical power of Jefferson's political utterances was a central feature of their appeal and the singularly most significant key to the endurance of his legacy. In sum, Jefferson's final thoughts on the meaning of the American Revolution and what that meaning meant for the government of the emergent American nation were extreme, but not in the sense of being aberrant or wildly misrepresentative. They were intensifications and purifications of what he had been saying all along. Perhaps alone among Jefferson's contemporaries, Madison understood all this. Adams kept trying to understand, but his classical assumptions about the need to discipline and balance political power prevented him from grasping the seminal source of Jefferson's message. Madison's defense of Jefferson was, in fact, more than a bit disingenuous, since his own personal correspondence and conversations with his mentor during the last 5 years of Jefferson's life gave him unique access to the final expression of Jeffersonian political wisdom, which was imminently vulnerable to capture by the Southern secessionists. But Madison also understood better than anyone else that Jefferson was more a political visionary than a political thinker. In that ultimate sense, his message defied capture by any single faction or interest group, including the ascendant Southern secessionists. Indeed, it defied all traditional assumptions about what was possible in politics. Madison tended to share Jefferson's foreboding fears of consolidation. Like Jefferson, he was trapped by the unattractive implications of the slavery question. He also opposed the restrictions on slavery imposed by the Missouri Compromise and sought relief in the illusion of diffusion, as well as the equally illusory belief that gradual emancipation was somehow still feasible. Moreover, one of his last acts as president was to veto the bill for internal improvements on the ground that it granted the federal government unconstitutional powers. In all these crucial ways, he and Jefferson agreed, making it possible for Madison to commiserate in good conscience with his aging mentor and his tortured thoughts after 1820. One area, however, where Madison preferred to maintain a discreet silence was Jefferson's familiar refrain about what had been intended at the Constitutional Convention. "Can it be believed," Jefferson asked rhetorically, "that under the jealousies prevailing against the general government at the adoption of the Constitution, the states meant to surrender the authority of preserving order, of enforcing moral duties and restraining vice within their own territory?" Jefferson's long-standing formula was straightforward. "I believe the states can best govern our home concerns and the general government our foreign ones." Or, as he put it in his most graphic formulation, "The federal is, in truth, our foreign government." Madison preferred to answer such assertions with elliptical statements. "The Gordian knot of the Constitution," he observed, "seems to lie in the problem of collision between the federal and state powers." While Madison himself wanted to blur both the sovereignty question and the extent of his disagreement with Jefferson, his wife, Dolly, in a note appended to her husband's papers soon after his death, spoke more candidly. Thomas Jefferson was not in America pending the framing of the Constitution, whose information in all that occurred in the convention, and of the motives and intents of the farmers was derived from Mr. Madison, whose opinions guided him in the construction of that instrument, was looked up to by many as its father and almost unanimously as its only true repositor. When it came to constitutional questions, in short, Jefferson often did not know what he was talking about. The disagreement came to a head, as it logically and legally was almost obliged to do, over Jefferson's colorful denunciations of the Supreme Court. The ultimate symbol of consolidation for Jefferson was the Marshall Court, sitting atop the federal government like a federalist sanctuary, with Marshall dispensing his judicial verdicts like some malignant Buddha. "The great object of my fear is the federal judiciary," Jefferson wrote in 1821, "that body, like gravity, ever acting with noiseless foot and unalarming advance, gaining ground step by step and holding what it gains, is engulfing insidiously the special governments into the jaws of that which feeds them." His most frequent image was of the Supreme Court as the subtle core of sappers and miners constantly working underground to undermine the foundations of our Confederated Republic. Most frustrating of all was Marshall himself, who seemed to possess magical powers of influence over his fellow justices. "An opinion is huddled up in conclave," Jefferson noted in disgust, "delivered as if unanimous, and with the silent acquiescence of lazy or timid associates, by a crafty chief judge who sophisticates the law to his mind by the turn of his own reasoning." At the very least, Jefferson urged, Marshall's quiet despotism should be challenged by requiring all Supreme Court justices to submit separate seriatim opinions, so that dissent within the court could be exposed and the illusion of godlike unanimity, Marshall's preferred effect, could be destroyed. Madison tended to agree with Jefferson about Marshall's formidable influence and the need for seriatim opinions by all the justices of the court. As long as the Chief Justice remained in place, one could expect no limits on the encroachments of the federal government when it came either to the slavery question in the Western territories or to the presumption of federal control over internal improvements. But Jefferson went much further, denying altogether the power of the Supreme Court to decide on questions of constitutionality. "The ultimate arbiter," he insisted, "is the people of the Union, assembled by their deputies in convention, at the call of Congress, or of two-thirds of the states." In other words, Jefferson denied the principle of judicial review and argued that the provisions made for amending the Constitution were the only proper procedures for deciding all questions of constitutionality. Madison, ever the diplomat with his lifelong colleague and friend, tried to avoid an open break by first suggesting that Jefferson's preferred modus operandi was rather cumbersome, then concurring that Marshall's decisions were indeed enough to test one's patience. Then, however, came the devastating clincher. "But the abuse of a trust does not disprove its existence," Madison accepted, and had all along accepted, the principle of judicial review. If there was the spirit of 76 which Jefferson could plausibly claim to know firsthand, there was also the spirit of 87, which Madison could claim with equivalent plausibility to know with comparable intimacy. "The clear intention of the framers of the Constitution," Madison told his friend, "was to make the Supreme Court the ultimate arbiter of federal versus state jurisdiction, the final judge, as Madison put it, of any trial of strength between the posse headed by the marshal and the posse headed by the sheriff." It was a rather astounding fact that the two Virginians had worked together so closely, so harmoniously for so many years, and this elemental difference of opinion had never surfaced before. Despite Madison's gentle and, as always, deferential tone toward his old friend, Jefferson could not have missed the point, for it came up again little more than a year later in another context. Jefferson had prepared a draft proposal entitled The Solemn Declaration and Protest of the Commonwealth of Virginia, in which he attempted to carve out a position that would permit his home state to oppose federal legislation for internal improvements. He identified control over its domestic affairs as one of the rights retained by the states, rights which never have been yielded, and which this state will never voluntarily yield. Then, after disavowing any desire to threaten the Union or risk any immediate rupture, declaring such a rupture as among the greatest calamities which could befall them, he threatened precisely the action that he had disavowed. Destroying the Union would produce a calamity, to be sure, but not the greatest calamity. There was yet one greater, submission to a government of unlimited powers. He sent the draft proposal to Madison with a note saying that he would not hazard so important a measure against your opinion, nor even without its support. Madison wrote back within the week. You asked an early answer, he observed, and I have hurried one, at the risk of crudeness in some of its views on the subject. The essence of the lengthy answer was that Jefferson's proposed draft was an anomaly without any operative character. Congress had passed the act funding internal improvements by a decisive majority. The only ground on which the act could be overturned was for the Supreme Court to find it unconstitutional, a course that was unlikely in the extreme, given Marshall's predilections and, irony of ironies, a course that Jefferson considered illegal anyway. Whatever one thought about internal improvements as a stalking horse for the evils of consolidation, Virginia had to obey the law. To suggest otherwise was to raise the specter that states need not abide by laws they found objectionable. This was a recipe for civil war and eventually anarchy, precisely the danger the Constitution was designed to avoid and, Madison urged ever so discreetly, hardly the course Jefferson wished associated with his name. Jefferson almost always listened when Madison offered constitutional advice. I have read the last with entire approbation and adoption of its views, he reported back to Madison, and have therefore suppressed my paper. A few years later, when Madison was defending Jefferson's legacy against the claims of extreme states writers during the nullification crisis, Jefferson's decision to withdraw his proposal made Madison's task much easier, and the benign duplicity of his defense more justifiable. Nevertheless, this last exchange and eventual collaboration with Madison are extremely revealing, and for reasons that extend far beyond the matter of Jefferson's vulnerability to, or rescue from, emergent Southern secessionists. Adams had been telling Jefferson for several years that the Jeffersonian version of what the American Revolution actually meant was both idiosyncratic and irresponsible. Now Madison was telling him that he had failed to grasp the central achievement of the constitutional settlement of 1787-88, which was to grant the federal government sufficient sovereignty to assure a national system of laws that all states and all individuals were obliged to obey. Both Adams and Madison, in their different ways, were informing Jefferson that the outstanding accomplishment of the revolutionary generation had been the realistic recognition of the need for limits as well as liberation, that the American Republic had endured because its creators made sensible compromises with political power, that the genius of the American Revolution resided in its capacity to harness, indeed to consolidate, the energies released by the movement for independence. But Jefferson, it turned out, had not seen it that way at all. He regarded himself as the untamed essence of the original revolutionary impulse, uncontaminated by any implicit understandings of 1776, here he parted with Adams, or any explicit compromises with political power in 1787-88, here he parted with Madison. Indeed, what his two old friends regarded as realistic limitations designed to assure the stability of the Republican experiment, he believed betrayals of the true meaning of the American Revolution, which was not to harness individual energies, but to release them. Even such intimate collaborators as Adams and Madison might consider his vision alluringly irresponsible, the kind of dangerously romantic aversion to established authority that one needed to get over. But Jefferson's statements during his last years of life, far from being aberrant ramblings, represented a consistent rededication to his visionary principles. All compromises with political power were pacts with the devil. All efforts at political consolidation were treasonable acts. In that sense, at least, Madison was right to insist that his old mentor would have disavowed any claims on his legacy by Southern states writers. His abiding legacy was a profound suspicion of governmental power of any sort, and a political rhetoric that depicted any relationship between the people and their government as problematic and contingent. The only kind observation about Madison that Jefferson ever made, at least the only one that found its way into the historical record, came on his deathbed, in the final hours when he was passing in and out of consciousness. But ah, he blurted out, he could never in his life stand up against strenuous opposition. While not fully fair to his most loyal friend, the remark captured Jefferson's derogatory sense of all political accommodation as a betrayal of principle. He remained a rebel to the very end. Educational dreams. The happiest moments in those increasingly unhappy last years were unquestionably private occasions. The hours in his garden, the afternoons on horseback, the early evening romps with his grandchildren on the back lawns of Monticello. The one bright spot amid the deepening sense of gloom about public affairs was provided by the project taking shape a few miles away in Charlottesville, barely visible on a clear day from his mountaintop, which Jefferson called his academic village. Now known, of course, as the University of Virginia, and recognized at the bicentennial celebrations of 1976 by the American Institute of Architects as the proudest achievement of American architecture in the past 200 years, it became Jefferson's major retirement project in 1817. In that year, he wrote a semi-scolding note to Madison, who was still trying to disengage himself from the presidency, for missing the first meeting of the committee charged with planning what was then being called Central College. "A detention at Washington, I presume, prevented your attendance. Circumstances which will be explained to you make us believe that a full meeting of all visitors, on the first occasion at least, will decide a great object in the state system of general education, and I have accordingly so pressed the subject on Monroe, the incumbent president replacing Madison, as I think will ensure his attendance, and I hope we shall not fail in yours." In case Madison had missed the point, Jefferson reiterated his annoyance at Madison's absence and his expectation that the next session would be a full meeting of all. The episode illustrates Jefferson's total immersion in the new educational and architectural venture. It never occurred to him that the outgoing and incoming presidents of the United States might have more important things to do. He threw himself into the project with the same youthful enthusiasm he had earlier given to the renovations of Monticello. Indeed, one can understand the architectural and construction challenges posed by the University of Virginia as convenient conduits for the same restless energies previously expended on his mansion on the mountain, which was now just about finished. It was the perfect building project to keep him busy. But it was also much more, since it involved cajoling the Virginia legislature for money, selecting a faculty, building a library, shaping a curriculum, in effect creating a model American university in his own image and likeness. Once Madison began attending the meetings of the Board of Visitors, he immediately recognized that the enterprise was intended to serve as a projection of Jefferson's personality. All members of the board understood they were appointed to follow Jefferson's lead, and all displayed unaffected deference for his judgment and experience. They were merely accomplices as he attempted, for what was obviously the last time, to institutionalize his dreams. His educational dreams went way back. First as governor of Virginia, and then, in his notes on Virginia, he had proposed a statewide system of public education designed to raise the Old Dominion out of its scandalously inadequate condition and place it on a par with the New England states. As the president, he had taken on George Washington's favorite scheme for a national university, presumably located in the nation's capital. But nothing came of the idea, and the academy established in New York, with his blessing, became an engineering school for army officers at West Point, not quite what he had in mind. Soon after his retirement from the presidency, his broodings assumed the more tangible form of a master plan for Virginia. Each county would be divided into a series of local hundreds or wards, modeled on the New England townships. Each ward would support a primary or elementary school funded out of public taxes, giving Virginia about 1,200 local schools to teach basic literacy. Then each county would contain an academy or secondary school, where the best graduates of the ward schools could learn their Latin and Greek and the rudiments of science, the poorer students at public expense. The capstone of the plan was a state university where the best graduates of the county academies would receive the best education available in America. Again, the poorest of the best on tax-supported scholarships. This scheme was pure Jefferson, magisterial in conception, admirable in intention, unworkable in practice. The Virginia legislature refused to provide the funds necessary for the comprehensive plan, but did appoint a commission to meet at Rockfish Gap in 1818 and make recommendations for the site of a state university. Jefferson had himself and Madison appointed to the commission, dominated the deliberations, and personally wrote the Rockfish Gap report that advocated the creation of a state university in Charlottesville. Madison lent an editorial hand in his familiar way, suggesting that Jefferson's use of the term monastic to describe the preferred collegiate atmosphere, while graphic, may not give umbrage, and that the idea of seeking professors abroad may excite prejudices with some. Jefferson expressed his own apprehension that Virginia was deciding to place a capstone on an educational foundation that did not exist. But his enthusiasm for the project overwhelmed his reservations. He relished the prospect of reviving the Jefferson-Madison collaboration one final time in yet another campaign to lead reluctant citizens toward truths that lay just beyond their vision. On the State Commission, for example, Jefferson explained to Madison that there is a floating body of doubtful and wavering men, so in his report, I have therefore thrown in some leading ideas on the benefits of education, in the hope these might catch on some crochets in their mind and bring them over to us. It was like the old days. Several old and familiar Jeffersonian patterns also presented themselves, like characters in a play reappearing for a final encore. There was the meticulous master of detail, operating with a grand but clear vision to guide him, yet never quite able to perform successfully in that middle region where detail and vision intersect to create cost overruns. Jefferson surveyed the site for the Charlottesville campus himself, even personally laid out the stakes. For the rotunda, which was to be the architectural centerpiece, he selected the Pantheon of Rome as his model and designed it to serve as both a library and a planetarium, with movable planets and stars on the interior of the dome manipulated by an ingenious and invisible set of pulleys and gadgets. Control should never be visible. He worked 4 hours each day for several months to assemble the catalog for the library of 6,860 volumes, which he estimated would cost $24,076. The false sense of mastery conveyed by such precise numbers kept being undermined by financial realities that always eroded Jefferson's most careful calculations. In 1820, the Virginia legislature, believing it was acting responsibly to meet the total costs, authorized the Board of Visitors to borrow $60,000. But the rotunda proved more expensive than Jefferson had anticipated, and he revised the estimate upward, again the misleading precision, to $162,364. The following year, facing heavy criticism from the legislature for the rotunda's cost, he predicted that $195,000 would completely cover all expenses. It did not, of course, but by then the pavilions were going up, the undeniable grandeur of Jefferson's architectural vision was becoming visible, and the momentum of the enterprise had passed the point where anyone but a foolish spendthrift would demand a halt. The recruitment of the faculty exposed again his contradictory attitude toward Europe as both a den of political iniquity and the cradle of all learning. He insisted that only European scholars could provide the high level of intellectual distinction necessary for a truly first-rate university, so he persuaded a reluctant Board of Visitors to dispatch Francis Gilmer, a bright young Virginia lawyer, to recruit prospective faculty in England, France, and Germany. When Adams learned that his old friend was scouring Europe for scholars, he poked fun at the unpatriotic scheme and jokingly reminded Jefferson of his most colorful condemnations of Europe as an intellectual swamp brimming with infectious political diseases. But Jefferson persisted in his quest for the best, that is, until Gilmer reported that none of the leading European scholars was interested In moving to an unfinished campus in the American wilderness, he tried to put the best face on this unexpected turn of events. I consider that his, Gilmer's, return without any professors will completely quash every hope of the institution. I think, therefore, he had better bring the best he can get. They will be preferable to secondaries of our country, because the stature of these is known, whereas those he would bring would be unknown, and would be readily imagined to be the high grade we have calculated on. In short, the commitment to unalloyed excellence had to be abandoned in favor of at least the appearance of respectability. Poor Gilmer, whose health was destroyed by the trip, eventually returned to America in late 1824 with commitments from 5 youngish foreign scholars who agreed to come over shortly. Adams suggested mischievously to Jefferson that at least one of these foreigners should be charged with teaching about the limits of human knowledge already acquired, though I suppose you will have doubts of the propriety of setting any limits, on human wisdom and human virtue. Jefferson chose not to respond. At least, and at last, he had his faculty. Then there was the ardent defender of unbridled freedom of thought and inquiry, who was equally ardent about the beneficiaries of such freedom reaching certain universal truths that all could then embrace as self-evident. Jefferson tended to associate restrictions on freedom of thought with religious creeds and doctrinal rules demanded by established churches. One of the most distinctive features of the University of Virginia was its disavowal of any religious affiliation. Virtually all the major colleges in the nation up to this time had defined themselves as seminaries for particular denominations or religious sects, and Jefferson went so far as to prohibit the teaching of theology altogether. He was also extremely sensitive to the way boards of trustees at other American colleges, usually dominated by the clergy, imposed restrictions on what could be taught or what books could be read. He was absolutely insistent that his university not succumb to such forms of censorship. And he meant it. But his acute sensitivity to religious creeds did not carry over to politics. As he explained to Madison, "There is one branch in which I think we are the best judges, an area of study so crucial as to make it a duty in us to lay down the principles which are to be taught. That area was the study of government, where the Board of Visitors had an obligation to protect tender minds from the treasonable thoughts of rank Federalists and Consolidationists." Jefferson went on to prepare a list of standard texts to be required in the classes on law and government. His list included the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, the Virginia Resolutions of 1799, and George Washington's inaugural and farewell addresses. Although certain numbers of the Federalist Papers ought to have given Jefferson pause, the list represented his attempt to ensure that the rising generation imbibe in doctrines of republicanism according to Virginia's version of the American Revolution. Once again, Madison rescued him from his lapse of judgment and called him back to his own first principles. "There were political creeds just as there were religious creeds," Madison observed, "and Jefferson would not want to impose, albeit inadvertently, his political values in the manner of a priest or pope. Moreover, it was not easy to find standard books that will be both guides and guards for the purpose. The Declaration of Independence, for example, could be read in different ways by different people, one of Madison's most telling and pointed acts of understatement, and Jefferson's selection of the Virginia Resolutions of 1799, though flattering to Madison himself, who had written them, left much room for hesitation because of their narrow and local focus. Madison already sensed danger in these earlier defenses of states' rights and wished to protect both Jefferson and himself from being appropriated by more militant Southern spokesmen. All in all, the very idea of a required list of readings," Madison concluded, "was perhaps misguided. I have, for your consideration, sketched a modification of the operative passage in your draft," he noted discreetly, "with a view to relax the absoluteness of its injunction." As usual, when Madison talked in this prudent